Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Today I'm pleased to have as my guest Ira Glass, who has been called the best radio host in America by Time Magazine. Ira is the host and producer of the award-winning public radio program This American Life, and now editor of a collection of essays, The New Kings of Nonfiction. Welcome, Ira.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Actually, before I talk about the book, I'd like to ask you about your television show. I'm curious because I don't have cable and I'm not able to watch Showtime.
Okay.
I understand is the new HBO.
Right, in that case, I will perform the first four episodes for you right now. I hope you have 2 hours. The show is designed to be just like the radio show, or as much as you can make something like a radio show, but having pictures. We don't do a thing where we film me in the radio studio or anything like that. What we do is that in the way that the radio show, we go out in the field and we find people and we tell their stories. With the TV show, we basically go into the field with cameras and we shoot it like a movie. It's shot in widescreen and it's actually shockingly beautiful the way that the cinematographer does it. And we go for the same kinds of stories, which are emotional, you know, stories about real people where compelling things happen to them that one can relate to. That sounds so terrible when I describe it like that, or so clinical. But it's much like the radio show, but on TV. And in fact, like right now, if you have computer access, you can actually watch them online. They're all for sale for like $2 each at the iTunes store. You can download them and watch them.
Well, you know, speaking of that, I have never in my life ordered a transcript or a CD of radio or television, except with one exception. And that was one of your episodes of This American Life. Can you guess which one that was? Because I think a lot of other people ordered it too.
Well, I don't know. This is a book show. Was it the episode, The Book That Changed My Life?
No, it was back a couple of years ago, Godless America.
Oh, Mike, that's the one you do. That's the one you got?
Yes.
That is the best selling CD we've ever put out. That is the most popular episode of our show that we've ever done in terms of people wanting copies of it.
Well, I discovered that much later. I didn't know when I ordered it at the time, but Julia Sweeney was just hilarious, and yeah. I wanted a copy of that.
But, well, I've discovered it's a really amazing thing. I didn't realize until that came out that atheists are such an underserved market.
Oh, yeah.
In the show, I should say for people who haven't heard it, Julia Sweeney basically tells the story of how she was raised Catholic, loved being a Catholic, had good feelings about her religion. She got a daughter, and when she had her daughter, she started taking her daughter to church, and then Julia decided as a good Catholic parent, she should read the Bible. She'd always intended, like, oh, someday I should read the Bible. And there was a Bible class where they would walk you through that at her church, and she started going. And the deeper she read into the Bible, the more it made her question what's in the Bible and her faith, until one day she finds, kind of incredibly against her will, that she just can't believe in the God of the Old and New Testament. She just finds she doesn't believe in God anymore. And she's quite reluctant about it, actually. She's somebody who had talked to God kind of in her head her whole life and really turned to God for sustenance and support. And she found through looking at the Bible that she just simply didn't believe anymore. And it got a crazy, crazy outpouring of emails and people wanting copies of it when it went on the air.
Well, and I understand, too, her mother and she don't get along too well on those points. But I was wondering if you were going to have her on your television series. Julia Sweeney.
It's funny. We're just figuring out how to get some of our regular contributors on. Mostly we're going out and doing documentary stories because mm-hmm. that's easiest to do, mm-hmm. you know, with the cameras. We've tried to browbeat David Sedaris and Sarah Vowell and David Rakoff and some of the others into doing stories. And truthfully, like, logistical things come up and nothing's come through yet. I don't know. It's actually the second conversation I've had today about this. Maybe I should call up Julia and ask. She can come on TV with us.
Well, you then have been working on your television program, but how did you decide to put together a book?
This book is done entirely as an act of charity. There's this literacy group that has branches in about half a dozen cities called 826, and there's one up in Los Angeles. They started in San Francisco. There's one in New York and a couple of other cities, and then they were opening one in Chicago. It was created by Dave Eggers, the guy who wrote that book. Written a bunch of books, but A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius is the novel that he's best known for. And he's a young guy, and he started this literacy group in San Francisco that's located behind a pirate supply shop, which outfits everything you'd need for the working pirate. Your peg legs, your parrot feed, that kind of thing, and a plank that you can walk, that sort of stuff. And then behind there, and so that's like a magnet for children, that store. And then behind the store, there's a literacy. You can come and learn to write, and you can have people help you with your homework. Neighborhood kids come. It's in the city. And so they opened up a bunch of those across the country, and then basically everyone who's ever met Dave Eggers got roped into helping raise money for these things. And I was glad to do it. And so they wanted to open up one in Chicago, and I basically did the anthology to help them raise money a year before the writer David Sedaris had done an anthology, a really wonderful anthology, actually, of short fiction pieces, his favorite pieces of short fiction. And he reads so widely, and not just funny stories, but just really beautiful stories. That's called Children Playing Before a Statue of Hercules. And that raised a lot of money for the New York chapter of this literacy group. And so for the Chicago one, I'm no expert on fiction, but I read a tremendous amount of nonfiction. So we put together a book of my favorite nonfiction pieces.
And you call your anthology The New Kings of Nonfiction. This is a special kind of nonfiction. You say you had trouble even describing this kind of nonfiction, that you didn't want to call it literary, but it is creative.
Yeah. I mean, there's a name for it. There's sometimes people write about this idea of literary nonfiction, which I feel like as a title is just a horrible bore. I'm a total snob about it. I just think it's a dreadful thing to call anything. It's like challenging you to read it, literary nonfiction. And the thing that all these writers have in common, Malcolm Gladwell and Michael Lewis and Chuck Klosterman and David Foster Wallace and Susan Orlean and these others. Is that they're not just the great reporters. They're all fantastic reporters, and they're not all just out to actually document things that nobody else is documenting in their reporting. They all do that. But in addition, they're entertainers. They're funny, and the scenes are great, and the characters are great, and you get involved in the story and just can't put it down. And, usually we talk about what makes great journalism. We don't talk about it being fun. And all these writers have that. I mean, I wanted to make a book that would be really not just illuminating, but just incredibly, just a great, great read. And one of the things that's satisfying about this is that sometimes in doing the radio show, I'll come across a piece of writing that I just love that's great on the page but can't possibly work on the radio just because of its length. Mm-hmm. And so a number of these are stories like that that are stories that I just wish I could have put on the radio and haven't been able to.
Well, from what I gathered in reading your introduction, you kind of have a beef with schools of journalism. And I wondered, have you ever taught journalism?
I haven't. Because
I think you'd like to. I think you'd like to teach it the way you'd like it to be taught. I got that impression.
Well, it's funny. Like I briefly, before I started This American Life, I taught a semester at one of the colleges in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I taught radio documentary, production, and I don't think I was an especially good teacher. But part of the problem was that none of the students in this particular school knew anything about radio journalism, and they were all such beginners. And I feel like I had things that I could teach them, but they had never heard radio news done in a way that was any good, and I was having to bring them up from such nothing. That I don't think I was necessarily the very best person for the job.
But it seems that school of journalism's teach don't be amusing, don't be entertaining, and that you don't. In fact, you say in your introduction that you say fooey to that. That
yes,
your book says fooey to that.
Indeed, I do. Yes, I do. Yeah. No. And this comes from my experience having friends, coworkers who especially one office mate at NPR's Chicago bureau when I was a reporter for NPR's daily news shows. One of my office mates was somebody who in real life was a total charmer, very funny, very smart. And she would come back from, doing the reporting on her stories, and we would stand in the hallway and she would tell me and the other reporters these incredibly hilarious things that happened when she had on the stories, none of which ever appeared in her stories on the air. And I always would say to her, if that was good enough to tell us in the hall, like the radio listeners will want those little funny anecdotes and the little character moments. And she had gone to a very prestigious journalism school, and she said, well, no, she was taught that would be putting yourself in the story. to point out like the funny moment or the thing that was funny to her. And I always felt like well, you know, I really think that in our tradition in public radio, like, people don't want like a nonstop flow of facts. You know, like, it's part of our tradition that, you know, the reporter can have a human personality. In fact, if you don't have a human personality on the radio, you're not using all the tools that are at your disposal as somebody trying to get across the news.
And I enjoyed that about the stories, that the reporter was a part of the story and we went along with them for the ride.
Yeah, yeah. And all these, the reporting is very transparent. My very favorite one when it comes to that is Bill Buford, who wrote, this is an excerpt from one of my favorite books, a book that I've given away more than I've given away any other book, called Among the Thugs.
I knew that's the one you were going to talk about.
And what he's doing a really hard piece of reporting, which is he's trying to report on soccer hooligans in England. And these are these guys who would go on rampages after soccer games and turn over cars and beat people up and occasionally, truthfully, they would kill people.
In fact, I have to admit, I didn't really enjoy all the violence in that story.
Yeah.
But the story itself, go ahead, I didn't mean
to. No. It's an unbelievably violent story. But he himself is such a funny writer. And truthfully, he makes utterly clear that all he is a guy wandering around among these thugs who don't want to talk to him, and they're suspicious of him, and they don't like him at all. And periodically, like, things happen to him, people ignore him, people slight him, and he just says one moronic thing to them after another in a way that he's happy to report. And then there are these little moments where he writes, that one of my favorite passages is, he says, the thing about reporting is that it's meant to be objective. It's meant to record and relay the truth of things, as if truth were out there, hanging around, waiting for the reporter to show up. Such is the premise of objective journalism. What this premise excludes, as any student of modern literature will tell you, is the slippery, relative fact of the person doing the reporting, the modern notion that there is no such thing as the perceived without somebody to do the perceiving, and that to exclude the circumstances surrounding the story is to tell an untruth. And then he says, I do not want to tell an untruth and feel therefore compelled to note that at this moment in his story, the reporter was aware that the circumstances surrounding his story had become intrusive and significant, and that, if unacknowledged, his account of the events that follow would be grossly incomplete. And his circumstances were these. The reporter was very, very drunk.
No. But in fact, as he was telling this, going around with these thugs, I thought of the Pamplona, the running of the bulls. I felt like I was in the middle of this herd of bulls, and yeah. I felt that he was. He was physically at risk with what he was reporting.
Well, very much. I feel like it's one of those stories where it starts off about something. I mean, it's funny and it's very colorful, and the guys who he's talking to are very colorful. And then mm-hmm. It comes to be about this thing, and this is even truer in the book than in the excerpt. It comes to be about this thing which is so huge, which is he's writing in the end about the pleasure of violence, how mm-hmm. how there's a pleasure to going on a rampage, to being part of a rampaging mob, which sounds, when you say it, like, well, how could you get that across in writing? And I feel like what he's describing is so horrible, but because of the way he writes about it, he yeah. actually makes you understand what the fun would be
yeah.
in going along. And he actually experiences it. He hangs out with these guys for enough time that when the riot begins, it's euphoric. He just writes about it as being this euphoria in this way that when he writes it, you can totally understand. And throughout the book that he writes is so beautiful because he goes back to ancient pieces of writing, hundreds and thousands of years old, where other writers talk about being in these riots, some of them quite famous riots, and the feeling of euphoria they got. And at the end of his book, you get this feeling of this thing which started off to be about something quite small and specific, that is soccer fans. Is actually the book is about something huge and grand and something within us that is as basic as being able to love each other, actually. You know what I mean? Like, so there's a very primitive part of us which is ready to enjoy violence. That's the case he's making.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with Ira Glass, editor of a collection of his favorite stories. Ira, you mentioned some of the stories from your book, and I wondered if you have the one about the poker player, Jim McManus. I happened to have been reading that very story one morning when I was listening to This American Life, and this was the topic that was kind of an update of what Jim has been up to.
Yes.
And his was just, you're just cheering for him the whole way. That was a wonderful story.
Thank you.
What, though, if you had to pick a favorite, if you could do that, what would it be from the book, the collection?
I mean, I think my favorite story in the book is actually the one that leads the book. It's by this writer named Michael Lewis. And he writes about this 15-year-old high school student named Jonathan Lebed. And in the year 2000, the Securities and Exchange Commission comes down on this 15-year-old claiming that he had done some kind of manipulation of the stock market because he would go online and in chat rooms he would talk about the stocks that he liked and try to encourage people to buy them, which would, of course, drive the price up. And that's what he would do. And they basically made him turn over $285,000 that he had made online. No, he had made $285,000 online, and then he made him because they didn't have a case in the end. Actually, they had him turn over much less. And what's amazing about this story is that Lewis is so he's so acute in describing the parents and the kid and what they're like and
yeah, I loved it about that story.
His parents are utterly clueless, and then there comes a point where basically Michael Lewis has a theory about what's going on in the stock market and the internet that's so completely convincing, and basically what he says is that the Securities and Exchange Commission totally has this wrong. They are totally going after the wrong person and going after this 15-year-old. And he makes the case for that in an utterly convincing way. And the whole story builds up to this scene where he talks to the chairman of the SEC. And I honestly, this was originally published in the New York Times Magazine. I honestly have never read a piece of reporting where a reporter does this, where he's in there with the head of the SEC, and the head of the SEC is saying a lot of just complete nonsense to him. And Lewis is in his writing, Lewis basically picks apart what the guy is saying, and not in a mean way, but somehow in a kind of bemused way, just lets you know that the guy is a complete liar. Or liar, I mean, he's just completely clueless.
It makes him look foolish, yeah.
He makes him look very foolish. But somehow, and I got to say, this is totally a writing trick. Usually, I think if you were to do that, or if most writers were to do that, the writer would come off looking like kind of a bully or a brat. And somehow Lewis seems like the most reasonable person in the room. You know what I mean? Like, there's the most cheerful, happy piece of reporting where he's just saying, like, look, he's got nothing against this, you know, the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, but the guy just doesn't know what he's talking about. And it's just a fantastically graceful piece of writing.
Well, I really enjoyed that one. And I also enjoyed Lee Sandlin's essay on the World War II. In fact, I had read it, and when I was watching Ken Burns' film on the war, I had recorded it. I would stop the tape and say, wait, and I would read from this essay a part. This is what the Battle of Midway really was like. And I just loved, I happened to be interested in World War II anyway, and I found his article just fascinating.
Yeah, he does an incredible thing. I mean, what his thesis is that he says that we have forgotten what war is really like, and he says, you know, to take an example, let's talk about World War II, which, as he says, it's the largest event in history. You know, mm-hmm. like you know, just the number of people involved, the number of people killed. You know, you kind of can't miss it. You know, like all the movies and TV shows about it. And then he starts off the article going around to people asking, just, you know, what happened at Midway, in the Battle of Midway? What happened at, you know, this place and that place, the sort of the timeless battles, and nobody knows. And the thing is partly about, in
and
a way,
that's why the title is Losing the Battle.
Yeah, losing the war. Eventually memory fades. Mm-hmm. And he writes about why that happens and if we should care that it happens. I mean, he talks about how when soldiers came back, they wanted to forget, you know, instantly. Everybody involved wanted to, but also he writes so compellingly about all the things, the culture of war, of being in a war, and how it's so radically different from peacetime culture and the way that you think and feel, It's one of those pieces of writing that once you read it, I mean, it's like you say with the Ken Burns thing, like from the little bit that I've, the little snippets that I've seen of it, I see that in a way that's utterly shaped by Lee Sandlin.
Yeah. And just to remind listeners, the title of your book is The New Kings of Nonfiction. And you say new, but these are not inexperienced writers. These are well-known writers. I mean, when I thought New Kings, I didn't expect to find such experienced, award-winning writers in this collection. But you call them new.
I mean, I guess.
And the stories aren't actually recent either, not necessarily recent. So, but you called it new because?
It seemed like a jazzy title. I mean, I guess I think of like the Kings of Nonfiction. I guess I'm old enough that I think of that as being like Tom Wolfe and Gay Talese, mm-hmm. and that generation of writers. Norman Mailer, when he writes nonfiction, yeah. I feel like those guys are the giants. And I feel like this was saying like, okay, who's the next generation? What do they stand for? And you know, these are the names that I collected.
And I don't think you intended any chauvinism by calling them kings, but there are only two female journalists included in the collection. But
yeah,
have you gotten any flack about that?
Yes, women? I have. Yes, yes, starting with my wife, and
oh.
rightly, and rightly, who is a journalist herself, and rightly so. Yeah, I have. But it's interesting. I talked to Susan Arlene, is one of the writers in the collection. She wrote The Orchid mm-hmm. Thief, and she's written a number of collections of her books, and she's in and she's in the New Yorker, and just an incredible writer, and. We did an event to publicize the book, and we talked about this on stage, where she said that actually, you know, while there are really, really wonderful women writers of nonfiction, including Joan Didion and Renata Adler and Janet Malcolm and just many, many people, she said it's so much harder as a woman. Like basically, if you want to have children. To do the kind of work she does, where she'll just go and live with somebody for 2 or 3 weeks, you know, to get to know them. She says it's just incredibly difficult, and that there are far fewer women doing it.
Well, because these writers too that you've collected, they go out and experience this that story about Saddam Hussein.
Yeah.
Tales of the Tyrant was just, oh my goodness, I really enjoyed that. But what you apparently read a huge variety. Do you have other favorite things that you read?
Joe wants to know. You're not asking for yourself.
Well, because I have read all these wonderful stories that I figured that you had, in fact, you say you kind of piled up these wonderful stories that you like to read. So I got an idea of what you like to read, but Joe wants to know and the listeners
okay,
want to know.
Okay, here he is. Here's Joe wanting to know. Ira, I'm just curious. You have no time, I would think. So when you do have time, what do you read? What kinds of things?
I mean, truthfully, most of what I there are two broad categories. One category is I'm reading magazines, so I'll read the New Yorker, I'll read the Atlantic. I read the New York Times every day, and I'll read a little bit online. There's some some websites that I go to every day, and that's pretty much all the time I have. I mean, especially right now with us producing the radio show and the television show. And all the time constraints for that. If I have half an hour where I can read anything during the day, it's a lot. And so there's that. I mean, the other category is basically things my wife encourages me to read. The way that my marriage works is that my wife will just fall in love with a book or a TV show or a movie, and then basically my taste becomes hers or her taste becomes mine. And so because of her, I read Michael Chabon. Cavalier and Clay, and my experience of the world is that she will go out and then she reports back to me on when she read Chabon's new book, the one about the Jews in Alaska, and then she'll just be like laughing and she'll tell me this scene and that scene and this scene and that scene. So by the time I finally read it, I feel like I've actually already experienced a lot of the book, which I totally recommend. I mean, if people feel like they could hire her out or something, I think it's a great service.
In fact, I think I sometimes spoil what my husband's going to read because I read him as I'm reading it because I think it's so fascinating and I read to him. And he's now reading a book that I have been reading to him and I'm wondering how much of it's going to sound new to him.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'll bet your wife then liked the way – I loved the conclusion to your introduction when you talked about this as the golden age of reporting and writing, but also a golden age for crap journalism.
Yeah.
And but you end on such a positive note that that a lot of daily reporting just reinforces everything we already think about the world, and it doesn't have this sense of discovery and curiosity that these stories that you've collected have.
Well, because of the shorthand that people do in doing daily journalism when it's bad. You know, they refer to, you know, there's this side, there's that side, and it's all about what everybody already thinks of Iraq and healthcare, and you know, just it's all based on, we're not going to tell you anything new. We're just going to move around the categories you already know and tell you kind of who's up and who's down. And
you don't, having listened to them or read them, end up feeling like a better person, which is what you said about these stories, that you, when you come out of them, you feel like a better person, more awake and more aware and more appreciative of everything around you.
Well, there's this thing that I think is important, you know, in these stories, and that, and truthfully, like in making the radio show, that I think that it's important that a certain kind of story have a feeling of discovery, and that there are moments where one is surprised at how things really are, and you know, there are moments of like pleasure and amusement and surprise, and just like the sheer pleasure of discovering the world. I feel like fitting that into the story reinforces the fact that we live in a world where joy and empathy and surprise and humor exist, which is so missing from the daily news.
Well, it's been all of those things, spending this time with you, Ira. It's been certainly a delight and a pleasure. And thank you for joining us here on Nancy's
Bookshelf. That was a
pleasure
for me, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ira Glass is editor of the New Kings of Nonfiction. After a break, I'll ask journalist Edward Humes about our dirty love affair with trash. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest is the author of 11 critically acclaimed nonfiction books, including Monkey Girl, Eco Barons, and the bestseller Mississippi Mud. Journalist Edward Humes has received the Pulitzer Prize, the Penn Award, and numerous other awards for his journalism and books. He has written for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and Los Angeles Magazine. His latest book takes us on a journey inside the secret world of our biggest export, our trash. Garbology, our dirty love affair with trash, digs through our epic piles of trash to reveal not just what we throw away, but who we are and where our society is headed. Edward Humes, welcome.
Thanks.
You know, your title is Garbology, but that's not a term that you originated. Where does that term come from?
Well, it's got an interesting history, but it became most familiar through the work of an archaeologist by the name of Bill Rathje at the University of Arizona. And he made a study of modern garbage in much the same way archaeologists study what's left behind by ancient civilizations. And he theorized that you could learn a lot about our culture and our habits by looking at our trash. And I think he was right.
So he was the first garbologist.
Yes. That was the term that came to be used for what he does, kind of play on garbage and archaeology, garbology. But it now has come to mean the study of our trash and what we can learn from it. So it seemed like a good title.
So this professor at the University of Arizona founded this, the Garbage Project, and his students then started studying garbage. And I thought it was so interesting, the things that they found, depending on the kinds of trash they would dig through, they could actually tell relative income of the people whose trash they examined.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, obviously our trash reveals a lot about us, everything from our, use or misuse of birth control devices to how much alcohol we actually consume versus what we say we consume, which no surprise, perhaps. There's a big disparity there.
Yeah. In fact, you said we overestimate our good habits and underestimate our bad ones.
Yeah, you'd think that this neighborhood in Tucson that he was looking at had cornered the national market on cottage cheese and whole grain products. If you believe what people said, if you looked at your trash, you saw a much greater percentage of potato chip bags and things like that. You know? The funny corollary of that, though, was that people were uncannily accurate in estimating their neighbor's alcohol consumption.
And so they call this the lean cuisine syndrome. We eat good here. We eat really good here.
Yes, exactly. And that shouldn't be surprising, I guess, to anybody. But what it's just part of our almost delusional behavior when it comes to our waste, that we don't really see how much or what sorts of trash we make. And of course, that's one of the big problems.
Yeah, in fact, you commented that what we know and what we think we know about garbage are quite different. And one thing I found interesting, too, in this with this garbage project, that they discovered that if households have a larger trash can, they produce more trash.
Yeah, that's one of Bill Rathje's garbology rules, that trash will always fill whatever void you give it to put it in. So,
so I think you might expect that you could get an idea of relative income of a household, but I think that might surprise people that you fill up the garbage can no matter what size it is.
Yeah, well, conversely, if you give them a smaller can, they constrain their waste a little bit. So, one of the other weird things he found was that communities that tried to do something about toxic and hazardous waste and made these special collection days actually made the problem worse, because invariably people had forgotten all these paint cans and other dangerous things they had piled up in their garages, and then they missed that special day when the collection was supposed to be. And so they just, now that they were conscious of this material, they just hurled it in the regular waste bin and it went where it wasn't supposed to go. So it was not a good way to try and
one of the unintended consequences
when they're
exactly trying to do something good.
Our waste system is filled with those unintended consequences.
My guest is Edward Humes. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. And I thought it was interesting, too, what they discovered when these students were, the professors were going through garbage. They discovered something about candy. You remember that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. If you want to give something good on Valentine's Day, don't give candy, because it always ended up in the trash. Well, not always, but in great quantities ended up in the trash. Unlike, for instance, Halloween candy, which almost never showed up in the landfill.
So people eat their Halloween candy, but it makes you wonder, well, what was it about Valentine's candy that people ended up not even opening it, perhaps, just throwing it away?
But apparently people wanted to receive something, other tokens of love than fattening sweet stuff.
Also, the U.S. Census Bureau found that what the students were doing, what they were learning about trash, was something that was helpful for them. Remember that they were trying to calculate two-parent households, and the U.S. Census Bureau had a margin of 40% error when they were trying to calculate this. And so they asked these students, well, help us out here. Help us know how many people really are in the other two parents in this household.
Yeah, well, that's it turned out to be an excellent tool for drilling down into the demographics that the census couldn't capture, because you could really figure out, in large part, gender and in some respects age and the number of people in households based upon their trash. And that worked across all demographics, too. It was kind of an interesting adjunct. But for a variety of reasons, the U.S. Census Bureau decided not to move forward with that particular project. They felt like sorting through people's trash probably was not going to be well received.
Although it was more accurate. The formula that the students had was an accuracy of more or less 2.5%, and the Census Bureau was off by 40%. So,
yeah, it's not amazing, but trash doesn't lie.
Yeah, that came out in your book too. Yeah, yeah, that what we say or what we think is not necessarily the truth, but our trash tells the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, another thing then I thought was interesting that the students had the trash delivered to them and they would poke through it. But then one of the professor's colleagues then says, but where's the dirt? And where did that send him, this Professor Rathje? Remember when they asked him, where's the dirt? And so they decided, well, maybe we shouldn't be having the garbage delivered to us. Maybe we should go out and get our hands dirty.
Yeah. Yeah, they wanted to go and actually explore the disposal point, the landfills, to see what they could reveal and how they behaved. Because it turned out, when you drill down, as he ended up doing, and get these core samples from our landfills and going down 20, 30 feet into the time machine of our waste, those landfills didn't behave at all as were expected. It was thought everything inside them would decompose and break down. And that was only happening in rather spottily, depending on the type of waste. And other times, things were mummified and perfectly preserved for decades, newsprint, articles, even bowls of guacamole. You know, they'd be crusty and nasty on the top, and then you'd wipe away the top layer, and it'd still be green inside after years and years. You know, avocado, one of the most perishable things on the planet, was still identifiable. Hot dogs, well, maybe we shouldn't be surprised they last forever, but
they're full of preservatives.
Exactly. So, yeah, his work in landfills really not only revealed some things about, you know, the nature of our garbage and what people throw away, but revealed new information about the nature of landfills as a disposal solution.
Yeah, because we might, we wouldn't know how old that guacamole is, but newspapers, we can see the dates on that. You mentioned in your book that you could dig up a 50-year-old newspaper. It would be intact and readable. You could read about President Truman in this trash that was dug up after 50 years.
Yeah, that was a surprise. But upon reflection, it made sense because these huge piles of trash we create that we call landfills is a very protected and often airtight environment, and things were preserved. And actually, Rathje argued that was a virtue of landfills, that it kept things from that might mm-hmm. be harmful to the environment segregated.
But then those of us who buy things that are biodegradable, that's kind of a disappointment because we think we're doing good if we buy something that's biodegradable. But if it gets in a landfill, it doesn't break down either.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion about how things break down and what they do in the natural environment versus when we put them in landfills. And then you have products, you know, new kinds of potato chip bags or whatever that are labeled compostable or degradable, but the fine print says you have to have really specialized equipment to make it happen. And so our consciences are relieved when we choose products like that. And then it turns out that the benefits are never realized. So there's a lot of confusion on across the board on that, the properties of our waste, so to speak.
My guest is Edward Humes, and his book is Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. And I thought it was interesting, too, that the students in this garbage project, or as they might like to call it, Le Projet du Garbage, because it sounds better in French.
Yeah, that French makes it sound so good.
But I thought this was interesting. They discovered that the more repetitive your diet, the less food you waste. And there's a tremendous lot of food that was wasted. I mean, that comes as a surprise.
But the fact that food waste is enormous.
But that if your diet is more repetitive, you waste less food.
Yeah, and there's a couple of reasons for that, but the main one is, and they saw a good example of this, is there was a kind of a meat shortage at one time. Demand was exceeding supply, and so people were either hoarding beef or buying cuts that they were unfamiliar with, and they ended up wasting it because they didn't know how to prepare it well how to treat that particular cut of meat that they were unfamiliar with. And so that ended up creating more waste. And that goes for all sorts of unfamiliar food versus things that we habitually have all the time and we know how to prepare and minimize the wasting.
Well, you know what? I love the story that third graders came up with a way of wasting less food. Remember what they voted for themselves? That they decided that if they paid attention when they were eating, instead of talking so much, they would eat and not have all this food to be thrown away.
Yeah, can you imagine that, having a group of third graders impose a silence rule at lunch so they could concentrate on their food and finish before before their meal period was over? That was remarkable. But, you know, it's amazing how simple ideas can alter the trash and waste landscape, and they were so clever in coming up with that.
Yeah, I was really impressed with the third graders who would vote a 20-minute rule of silence at their mealtime so that they could they would waste less food. Well, you have some suggestions in your book. You have five suggestions that you came up with for what we can do about this situation. And I was delighted to see that out of these five suggestions, Ed, two of them were directly related to Chico. And the third one, I don't know if you, because you didn't include this story in your book, but there was a guy who, because I know the fitness club where I go regularly there, a few years back, the bins for recycling water bottles would just fill up practically. I watched it hourly would fill up.
Oh, yeah.
It was so depressing to see that. And one day outside waiting for yoga class to start, this friend of mine said, I have come up with an alternative. It's a reusable stainless steel bottle for water. And he went on to market it. This was Robert Seals. And he created the Clean Canteen right here in Chico.
I did not know that. But
well, yeah. So your next book, you could say that Chico was the birthplace of the Clean Canteen, which now you see all over the country. But the story that is wonderful, and Ed, I don't know if you've ever thought about writing a screenplay, but I would love for you to write a screenplay for this story. And that is the story of Chico Bag. How did that get started?
Oh, well, that's, you know, one of those amazing unintended consequences. Andy Keller was going to the landfill that serves Chico and was kind of appalled at what he saw. And one of the, if you hang out at any landfill, one of the things you see is the immense amount of plastic bag waste and how hard it is to contain it because they're so light and unless they're tied down or filled with something, they just blow around. In fact, sometimes they can just sort of rise up if the wind currents are right, and it's like having a flock of plastic birds flapping around. And some landfills have people who have to herd them and track them down and keep the plastic bags from escaping into the surrounding environment. So they create a lot of waste issues that really appalled Andy Keller on this visit. And he's driving back, and he started seeing plastic bags everywhere by the side of the road, and he didn't know how big a problem it was at that point. He just thought that there had to be a better solution, and that led him to experiment with making a kind of reusable bag. He had just took a buyout in his job in the software industry and was looking around for the next thing in his life. And pretty soon he found himself at a secondhand store buying a sewing machine and experimenting with designing reusable bags. And that was the birth of the reusable Chico bag. And
it's amazing that he had not only the entrepreneurial skill, but the sewing skill.
Yeah, well, he had been a scrapper as a kid, and he had learned how to sew. He had 101 different jobs growing up, and
just like
one of them involved learning sewing.
I mentioned that one of your suggestions was to stop buying bottled water, and this friend of mine that came up with this stainless steel bottle had a skill of working with metal. So he had a talent there that he made use of, and then Andy Keller can sew. and so that was key to his getting started in getting Chico Bag off the ground.
Yeah, so, you know, the whole idea behind his work is that it's kind of silly to be consuming 500 disposable grocery bags a year, which is what the average American does, when you could just have a couple of reusable ones and end it right there. Cut off that entire side of our waste production. And, you know, he calls plastic bags the gateway drug to waste. And if you could just start with cutting out that particular bit of the waste stream, it can lead to all kinds of other good things and new ways of thinking. And you know, he's got a point. It's perverse, is it not, to create a product that is designed to be immediately thrown away as soon as you're done with it, out of materials that last for thousands of years in the environment. I mean, that's the height of paradoxical behavior, and it creates an environmental problem. So, you know, so a great solution is to bag the bag and use a reusable one.
My guest is Edward Humes, and he is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. But now, Andy's success, though, brought along, which, well, it started to be a problem, but then it turned out to be something good that happened, and that is he attracted the attention of these big manufacturers of plastic bags. And then what?
Yeah, well, he became a very vocal advocate for reducing plastic bag waste and use. And he did a couple of things. One of them was to create this alter ego, this character he called Bag Monster. And he made this costume out of 500 plastic grocery bags. The idea being that represents our annual individual consumption. He looked like this, well, a monster made out of plastic bags. It was an incredibly puffy looking thing. And he'd go out to schools and he'd do public awareness campaigns. And people started asking to borrow it. And he ended up creating, you know, something like 100 of these loner costumes. And Bag Monster is pretty popular. It's got his own website now and everything. So that started drawing the kind of attention to plastic bags that manufacturers and of plastic bags didn't care for. And he combined that with a website that presented some information about plastic bags and their use and their impact on the environment that the plastic bag industry took issue with. And they ended up suing him and accusing him of spreading false information that harmed their businesses.
Yeah, because they can't have this. They can't have reusable grocery bags. We got to make an example of this guy.
Well, that's what Andy Keller felt, that he was being singled out and as a critic. He had support. He was campaigning for, and Bag Monster was campaigning for city and town restrictions and bans on plastic bags, and that certainly was a threat to the plastic bag industry. So they, you know, identified what they thought were was false information and on his website and went after him. You know, that it was a very clever legal campaign. It was filed in a state on the East Coast that doesn't have anti-SLAPP laws, which in California could have led to a quick dismissal of this particular lawsuit. And it's a very costly thing to litigate this sort of action, but he ended up fighting it, and hired a bunch of experts and was able to show that the information he presented was factual or based on the best data,
or even understated.
Or even understated. The amount of plastic that we use may actually be much greater than his website asserted. So, and it wasn't, you know, he wasn't making stuff up. He was quoting authoritative sources like the EPA and the Los Angeles Times and so forth. So it ended up settling. Both sides claimed victory, but the bottom line was that the more and more communities are going with Mr. Keller's vision and are adopting these restrictions and bans on plastic bags.
So Andy Keller sees recycling as a crutch to allow us to feel better about our overconsumption of disposable things. But there's another story in your book. Bea Johnson makes us feel good about, she says it's not a sacrifice to recycle. In fact, she has four R's. What are her four R's?
Yeah. Well, in addition to the usual recycle, reduce, reuse, she adds refuse. Not to be confused with refuse, but refuse the waste. Refuse the overpackaged and wasteful products. Refuse to buy the single use and disposable things, and insist on the durable, the reusable, the thing that you can take into your home and say, this is something I want in my life for, you know, for the duration, that I want to pass on to my children, as opposed to buying things that you know are going to end up in the trash very quickly. And when you make that kind of switch in your thinking, you really change your habits of consumption In some respects, you downsize your life. In fact, that's what provoked us in the first place. She and her family moved from a very large house to a smaller one, and they suddenly realized they had a lot of stuff that they had no room for. And then they realized they had a lot of stuff they didn't need. Yes, do we really need three sets of china? Do we really need that second couch that nobody sits on because it's so darn uncomfortable? Do we really need this, that, and that? And boy, did we spend a lot of money on stuff we didn't really need or want. And that led to a soul searching and a rethinking. So, you know, when Bea goes to the supermarket, she brings her own containers, whether it's to get deli meat or cereal or what have you. She tries and buy unpackaged in bulk. And she found out a couple things, either that really didn't have any financial impact on her, but it certainly lowered the amount of waste she was generating, or it was actually cheaper to buy in bulk, to buy in large quantities. She does things like buy a large container of vinegar and make cleaning products out of that with a little Castile soap, which is a chemical-free liquid soap. And those are the only cleaning products she needs for her house instead of the, you know, six or eight tile cleaners and spray cleaners and single-use plastic bottles that cost so much more.
But, you know, people are going to resist that. I don't want to take reusable containers to the grocery store. And this is true in all aspects of our life, really. It's easy to oppose, and you make this point, it's easier to oppose change than to propose it. And, for example, there's a woman who picks up trash on the beach, and people love to go join her picking up trash on the beach because it makes us feel good. But admitting that we lead wasteful lives that need to change does not make us feel good. You make this point in your book. Something like picking up the trash, we feel good about that, but we don't want to admit that our lives are wasteful and we need to change that. But, you know, Bea has an interesting point, too. Her husband calculated that they saved 40% on their household budget by these changes they made in their lifestyle.
Yeah, and that's certainly a big incentive because when you make decisions that reduce waste, that focus on, you know, getting things that are durable and long-lasting rather than disposable and have to be replaced all the time, and you buy efficiently in bulk and all those things, you save a lot of money. Even if you don't give a darn about the fate of the planet or future generations, you have a great incentive to build in less waste. Because what is waste? Waste is wasting stuff. That stuff has value, and we're paying for it. And, there's a reason why our grandparents told us to clean our plates and not waste stuff, because it makes sense.
Thank you so much, Ed, for being my guest today. It's been a pleasure.
Same here.
My guest is Edward Humes. His book is Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.